The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea Fellow, for those of you who have not met before. Is it ready? I am. Okay. So, this morning I'd like to talk about kind of the nuts and bolts of practice a little bit, about mindfulness practice in particular, how we explore our experience. And so this is two qualities I really want to explore, one being mindfulness, and the other being investigation. They really work together, mindfulness, just meeting experience, knowing what's happening in the moment, and then investigation being kind of a way or an attitude of how to explore experience. There's so many different ways to do that, and so I just wanted to explore some of that with you today. So mindfulness itself is a very natural quality of mind. It's a quality of mind that is a capacity of being human, a possibility to know what's happening in the moment while it's happening. So that quality of mind itself is very supportive for us, and yet just simply knowing what's happening in the present moment while it's happening isn't necessarily enough for the kind of freedom and release from struggle that is possible with mindfulness practice. So, for example, if you were to tell somebody who'd never met mindfulness practice before, and they had some kind of reactive emotion going on, like anger, and you were to ask them, "Do you know that you're angry?" You know, they're probably going to say, "Well, of course I know I'm angry." So there is an awareness, some kind of capacity to recognize that one is angry. But typically in our habitual way of meeting the world, in our pre-mindfulness practice way of meeting the world, we might, in having anger in our mind, be more interested in what it is that is in the world that is triggering that anger, rather than being interested in the anger itself and what is happening in the mind around the anger. And that's the very shift of investigation that the Buddha suggested to us. This would be really helpful. Rather than focusing outwardly on what is happening in the world, to turn towards what is the inner experience of what's happening. Now, this is not to deny what's happening in the world, and it's not to... one of the things that often happens one of the ideas that often comes up for people in hearing this exploration of, okay, when you're experiencing something, the investigation, the mindfulness, the investigation means rather than, you know, having the attention out in the world to turn towards what's going on inside, then people take that to mean, well, I'm not supposed to do anything about what's going on outside. And that's not quite what the teachings offer here. And the teachings encourage us to really get familiar with what our bodies and minds are doing in the present moment, not as a means to just sit like a lump on a log and just watch the world go by, but rather to begin to understand when our relationship to the world is one of reactivity or one of responsiveness. There's a difference there, a reactivity being more that when we have things out in the world that we don't like, we want to get rid of them, we want to fix them, we want to change them, we may get angry or confused or frustrated or fearful. And so the way we are relating to the world in that situation contains reactivity. It's possible, this is where the Buddhist teaching, kind of the crux of the Buddhist teaching, it's possible to have the same situation happening in the world that would typically trigger an inner world of fear, confusion, reactivity, wanting things to be different. It's possible for there to be that situation in the world that would typically trigger that. And yet, through this practice of exploring, investigating what's happening inside, our relationship to what's happening in the world can shift to rather being one of hating and wanting to control and fix and change and being fearful and confused and angry and wanting things to be other than they are. It can move to more of an open-hearted relationship to the world, which when it meets the world, it connects. And through that connection itself has an inspiration to act from compassion and kindness, rather than out of reacting out of fear and confusion and anger. And so this investigation of the inner landscape of our experience doesn't mean that we might not end up taking action in the world. But the hope is, through this exploration, this investigation of our inner life, that we begin to meet the world with wisdom, with compassion, with kindness, with generosity, with a balanced mind rather than a reactive mind. And so that's the purpose behind this exploration of inner investigation. Sometimes, if we don't understand that the purpose is really to connect, we might think that it's all about just like, you know, sometimes meditation has the reputation of just being navel gazing, you know, just looking inside, and it's like disconnected from the world. But the teachings of the Buddha really aim to keep us in relation to the world, but in a skillful way. And so we explore what's happening in our minds and in our hearts with the interest in seeing if we can understand how these patterns of confusion and greed and reactivity happen. As we understand that, as we understand how those things happen in our minds, and we see that a lot of what goes on in our mind is something that can shift. We don't have to just sit back and live with our conditioned responses. The way our system is put together, it is possible to change our minds. Our mind and bodies are put together in a way that they can be learning systems and learning to move towards freedom from reactivity, freedom towards responsiveness rather than reactivity. So this is the kind of the underlying motivation for exploring, investigating our experience, exploring what it means to be mindful in a way that leads to a lessening of reactivity and a movement towards responsiveness. And paradoxically, maybe it sounds paradoxical, it certainly did to me when I first met this exploration. One of the ways to shift from reactive to responsive is to be aware of open to the reactivity itself. So if anger is happening in the present moment, again, it's a shift. Rather than being focused on what's out there in the world, when there is anger, to turn and see, what is this experience of anger? And so the shift is one of, rather than focusing on the triggers, to look at the experience of anger, the inner experience of anger itself. What's happening inside? When I first heard this, I thought, and it was around anger that I first explored this question of investigation, because anger was one of the states of mind that was really problematic for me. I could find often that I would be just frozen in anger, not really able to function. And so I was interested in understanding this. And then I read this book that said, well, pay attention to your anger. Notice that you're angry. And my initial thinking when I read that was, well, what good is that going to do? Isn't that just going to make me more angry to notice that I'm angry? And in some ways, fortunately, I'd kind of hit bottom at that point. And, you know, everything I tried to deal with this pattern in my mind, with the situations in my life, hadn't worked up till that point. And so I was willing to try something that sounded counterintuitive. And so I did. I began just seeing, can I know that I'm angry when I'm angry? And lo and behold, within the space of a few months, there were huge shifts for me around this pattern. Just that simple shift of, rather than being oriented towards the thing, the situation, the person in this case, a person who had been the trigger for the anger, rather than orienting towards thinking about that person and what I should say to them and how I should behave towards them, this is anger. This is anger happening right now. So that's the shift that I want to explore today, particularly in investigation. So the word investigation, often, at least the word in English, often triggers a kind of an idea or a belief of figuring out what's happening. Pulling something apart or finding all the component parts of, that's often what we think of when we hear the word investigation. We are often also interested, investigation also feels to us like figuring out why something is happening. And this is something we've got a lot of practice with, I think, you know, especially in the Western culture and the kind of psychoanalytic perspective that pervades a lot of our culture of, you know, understanding why something's happening in the present. Well, if I'm angry now, it must have something to do with my childhood. How might it relate to my childhood? Well, I was often treated badly on the playground, and, you know, I was always the one left out, and, you know, maybe it's got something to do with that. You know, kind of figuring out what are the, why am I angry, relating to kind of history. I mean, there's the obvious situation of anger at this person and stuff, but the investigation, the word investigation sometimes triggers a sense of, well, what is it connected to? How does it relate to my past? And potentially triggers a kind of thinking about the experience, thinking about the reactivity rather than what the investigation actually encourages is a being with the experience, not thinking about it. And so that's a shift for us. That's when we use the word investigation in this context, we aren't talking about thinking about or figuring out what's going on. We're interested in being with what is happening now. So not trying to figure out why something's happening through reflection or thought, but entering into a kind of an inner meeting. This is how it feels to be in this state right now. This is how it feels to be angry. This is how it feels to be confused. This is how it feels. So there's a kind of a feeling sense, a felt sense of the experience that we're touching into with investigation. So this, we could just, that one way to explore this, one way to explore investigation is simply to ask yourself, what's obvious right now? This is one of the keys, at least for me at this point in investigation, is just what's obvious? Not trying to pull things apart or pick things apart, but just what's right on the surface? What's here? What's here right now? This gives us the beginnings of a tool that allows us to more deeply understand what's going on inside. So asking what's obvious, what's happening right now, we just notice, like in anger. I mean, the very first time I was able to be aware that I was angry while I was angry, the most obvious thing about it was, this is unpleasant. This doesn't feel good. And so, you know, it's like, okay, yep, that's what's going on. It doesn't feel good right now. As I began to learn more tools, there's other explorations that we can open to. One of the helpful tools in being with experience is to open to, how does what's happening feel in the body? The felt sense of experience, the first place we often have access to that is in our physical body. Emotions, moods, states of mind often have some physical correlate. And in fact, often in the inner area here, in the guided meditation, I was encouraging a kind of a relaxation inside the body. You know, there's a lot of feeling that happens inside the body. And a lot of that happens with emotion. So fear, for example, you know, often creates a sense of agitation in the belly, or a sense of a kind of an energetic kind of feeling inside the body. Sometimes we use the word butterfly, right? You know, when there's agitation, you know, so there's kind of this fluttery kind of energy. Or fear might have a constriction in the throat. So all of our, much of our experience in terms of landing in our felt sense, often the body is a really helpful avenue for connecting with, and what is this experience that's happening right now? So you could, you know, just open to, and what's obvious in the body right now? What's the most obvious thing that's happening in the body right now? As a feeling comes up, as a reactivity comes up. We can work with this both in meditation and in our daily lives. I use this so much in my daily life. The very first mindfulness practice I did was in my daily life, exploring this anger. And the very first time I recognized that I was angry and was able to recognize, oh yeah, I was sitting at my computer. So this practice of investigation in a very light way, a simple way, can be worked with right in the midst of our lives. It's not just confined to times when we're sitting with our eyes closed in a room. We can actually work with this investigation in our daily lives. So another helpful, I'm going to say something more about just the kind of attitude of investigation in a way. I mean, really that openness to just what's here, what's obvious. It can have a really light touch. Again, with the idea of investigation, we often have this notion of, okay, I want to investigate my emotional reactivity right now. And I at least had this sense of, well, let me look at this. Let me, like, put it under the microscope. I'm going to, like, here it is. Let me, you know, it's like I would, like, sink my head into it and try to really figure it out again with that attitude of, like, diving in, pulling apart, trying to figure out. I've found through much practice and seeing how much of that kind of diving attitude creates kind of tightness and constriction in the mind, I've seen that a much more helpful attitude to bring is a very open, again, that what's obvious right now. There are many threads to an experience. You know, an experience of anger, for instance, that's one I know so well, so I often use it a lot in my examples. Anger has a lot of physical experience, pressure and heat in the body, tightness, constriction in the throat, even sometimes rigidity in the body. I found at times I was just like frozen, rigid, the whole body tense when I was experiencing anger. There's an attitude in the mind of lashing out. There can be a lot of thoughts in the mind about retribution, and you know, so there's a whole bunch of components to the experience. And there's also probably a lot of layers to that experience. You know, that anger may be laid on top of fear and may be laid on top of a feeling of not being seen and a feeling of not being met in our lives. So there's a lot of stuff that comes to put together an experience like that. And knowing that, I mean, we kind of do have a sense of that sometimes, that, you know, we see sometimes that our reactivity isn't just about what's happening here. Are you familiar with that? I mean, the sense of, I'm reacting to this thing, but it's like, you know, we see that we're dragging in something that happened last week or maybe even 20 years ago into the situation, and it's like we're seeing that situation through that filter. And so we know that there's a lot going on. And so, you know, knowing that, having the understanding that there's a lot going on, we can have the idea of, okay, I really need to dive in and see what's right in the middle of this. You know, what pull it apart. Have that sense of trying to pull it apart. And that's certainly one of the ways I approach things for quite a while in my practice. More recently, in the last few years, last 4 or 5 years or so of my practice, I've really come to appreciate a much more broad, light touch to this investigation. And just like gentle contact, gentle like meeting of experience. Sometimes we can think about polishing a bowl. You know, if you're polishing a bowl with a cloth, a soft cloth, this is the way we can meet experience. Not taking something and trying to like pick it apart and pull it apart. Just like this soft touch. A soft meeting of experience. With that soft, like I do this with my hands, this kind of open feeling. It's almost like, you know, yep, this big mess of something. Can I just put my arms around it in the broadest way and notice what's most obvious? This morning I came up with an analogy about our patterns like this. It's kind of like a kaleidoscope. You know, a kaleidoscope that has all these little different colors and bits of things. I have one kaleidoscope that has all these different broken shells in it, different shells. And you turn the kaleidoscope and you get to see, oh, there's that shell, and you see the different patterns that are made. The turning of the kaleidoscope reveals different aspects of possible patterns, but it's all the same stuff in there, right? It's like you're not seeing new stuff so much. Some of it's like revealed as other stuff falls away, but you get these endless patterns. And so it's kind of similar that, you know, instead of like trying to take the kaleidoscope apart, it's like, what's here with this pattern of the kaleidoscope. And in the next moment, things will shift and it'll be like a new piece of the pattern may become obvious. And then in the next moment, another pattern will shift and another piece of the pattern may become obvious. And so the light touched the broad, just like, oh, what's obvious over time begins to reveal what the deeper layers of the pattern are. And so it's not about like trying to dig in and find. It's more that with that light touch, there begins to be a kind of a continuity of the mindfulness. Like it's like, you know, the mindfulness is really meeting the experience and seeing how it's shifting and changing and seeing the different pieces of the experience. And with that, if we're just willing to meet it in that way, the mindfulness begins to reveal some of the deeper layers of that pattern. The continuity or the contact with experience begins to show us the deeper layers. And in a way, not even in a way, but it begins to reveal the why things are happening. But not the why necessarily of history, but the why of right now. Why is this happening right now? There's something that happens in the world. One example of this kind of investigation. And this is one that I've used a lot, so some of you have heard this one before. In the early years of my practice, this was in the time where I was really interested in understanding my emotional reactivity around this particular person. And anger was one of the emotions that came up. Loneliness was another. This was a boyfriend that had broken up with me. And so there was quite a bit of loneliness that came up. And I began to understand the value of just witnessing emotions through this, you know, starting with the anger. I began to get interested in just witnessing the emotions. And so I began to be curious about, oh, loneliness comes up sometimes. Okay, what's that? What does it feel like? What's going on? And so I began to notice a pattern around loneliness in particular, that when I went to bed at night, I was lonely. That did not particularly surprise me. You know, this was not like, wow, big news, I'm lonely when I go to bed at night. In fact, it kind of like made sense to me. So, but anyway, I was still interested in understanding it. So to me, ostensibly, the why of the loneliness had to do with, you know, memories associated with not being alone when I was going to bed at night. So that was in my mind, but I was just interested in understanding the loneliness, being with it. And so each night I would just, oh, here's the loneliness again. What is this loneliness? And it would just be that, you know, just gentle meeting. And initially I think obviously was, you know, the feeling, like probably some body sensations. As I explored over successive nights with this, you know, because it was pretty regular pattern. And this is one of the great things about patterns. You know, when you see something that happens regularly, you can kind of be prepared. It's like, okay, I was prepared pretty much as I was going to bed at night. Okay, I can watch this. So there I was, just each night, kind of prepared. And what is this? What is it going to feel like tonight? What's obvious tonight? And one night, it became very clear that the loneliness began. It's like a trigger, a flip of a switch. The loneliness began when I was setting my alarm clock. That was not obvious to me why that would be the case. I was kind of like, what? What does being lonely have to do with setting the alarm clock? It seemed very clear that there was some connection there. It was not obvious to me in the moment, but it was like flipping a switch. It was like there was something about that was connected to the loneliness, and I didn't understand it. But I just kept watching, again, night after night. I had the opportunity. I don't know how long this exploration took, probably several weeks. Again, this is patience, right? This is just willingness. It's like not thinking that we're going to investigate something once and, oh, there it is, done with it, check, okay, next. It really is a much slower process and a more process of patience to be curious about. Curiosity is a real support for investigation, to be curious about these things. And so continuing my exploration over the next few nights, seeing the loneliness arise with the setting of the alarm clock. One night, while I was setting the alarm clock, I saw a flash of a memory. A flash of a memory of being with my ex-partner in Disneyland, looking up at a clock. This was the memory that flashed in my mind. Looking up, we were in Tomorrowland, looking up at a marquee that had a digital clock on it. So there was a connection. I could see there was a connection between the memory and what I was doing. You know, that there was a kind of a cause and effect link between seeing the clock here and a memory that popped up. This was not unfamiliar to me, actually. You know, the seeing, you know, that we had a 10-year relationship, so much of my life was connected with him. And our memories are very associative, you know. It's like we pull things together. That's part of the way our minds work. But these kind of associations happen often subconsciously. Like this one, it was like just revealed in that moment that there was that mental association of digital clock with that, with my partner, with my ex-partner. And I could see in that moment that the loneliness that was coming up was not so much about going to bed by myself at night, but the story that I could see created around that memory was something like, oh, poor me, I used to be so happy, we did so many fun things, and I'm never going to have anybody that I'll ever do those kinds of fun things together with again. And that idea is where the loneliness was generated from. That was being created in the moment. The arising of our reactivity happens because of conditions from the past. I mean, clearly that had conditions from the past that was coming together, weaving together. The good times that we'd had in Disneyland, the 10-year relationship, the many memories that had been put together. And in the moment, the alarm clock setting, the linking the mind did of that with the memory, and the reaction to the memory. In the moment, that was what was constructing the loneliness. So that kind of investigation, that willingness to just, oh, what's here, what's here, what's here, revealed the cause or the kind of the root or the inner trigger. The outer trigger was setting the alarm clock. The inner trigger was a thought about something that was connected with that. And that was really where the reactivity was born, was from that inner trigger in the moment. So this is the kind of, I mean, I was kind of blown away when I saw that. It's like amazed that at the kind of that mindfulness could reveal something like that. This was, you know, several months into my practice, but I hadn't been meditating very long. And it was just kind of like, wow, this stuff's really powerful, you know, to be able to see something like that. What was more amazing to me, actually, was not the seeing of that, but the next night when I went to bed, I picked up the alarm clock, and of course the memory was there because it had been so clearly revealed. But what didn't happen was that loneliness did not follow from it. Somehow, the seeing of that connection broke the power of the reactivity to construct itself. because that was happening under the level of conscious awareness. And so the bringing it into the light took away its power, took away its ability to create that reactivity. That was even kind of more amazing. That seeing the next night, what I really saw is, wow, this is really helpful. You know, this really does help the mind to begin to let go of the ways that it responds. It begins to reveal the way that the mind creates its own reactivity. So I want to leave it. I've got so much more we can say about investigation, but these are the keys I want to. One thing I will say here, I mean, the main piece that I've been talking about here is investigating reactivity, because that's so much of where we get caught, where we struggle. But it's also really helpful because mindfulness has this two-part quality to it. It's got this. The word that came to my mind this morning was it's a double-edged sword, but in the best way. You know, we usually use double-edged sword to mean something negative, but in this, it's the best possible double-edged sword. It has the power, when we bring mindfulness to something that is unhelpful, a reactive state of mind, anger, confusion, fear, avarice, pride, when we bring mindfulness to a state of mind like that, it creates the conditions for it to appear less frequently in our minds. Just in this way that I've described, the seeing of that loneliness over and over, night after night, it helped the mind understand how to let go of it. Not through me deciding, oh, I'm going to let go of that, but the understanding was what allowed it to let go. So mindfulness has that edge to the sword. It supports a letting go of reactive emotions. The more we are mindful of reactive emotions, the more the conditions are created for them to weaken. The other edge of the mindfulness sword is the more that we attend to and recognize beautiful, wholesome qualities in our experience, the more we recognize love when it arises, connection, compassion, generosity. The state of mindfulness itself is a wholesome quality when we can recognize, oh, this is mindfulness. When mindfulness recognizes wholesome qualities, it creates the conditions for those to appear more frequently in our minds. Because my understanding of why that works, this is my own idea of it, but you know, I think inherently our system, our organism, wants to move towards well-being. And when we're kind of acting from a level of like awareness that's like from here up, you know, we're not really knowing everything that's going on. Our system just kind of goes for the quick hit of well-being. It's like, oh, I can get that. I can feel good if I have that piece of chocolate, or I can get rid of that. I'll feel better if I feel like I have control over something. And so the mind is kind of operating in this very immediate gratification way. But the more mindful we are, the more we turn towards the states of reactivity, the more the mind gets the information, yeah, this state of anger, that very first insight I had, yeah, this doesn't feel good. This is not conducive for well-being to be in this state. And so mindfulness begins to give the mind the education that the states of reactivity are not conducive to well-being. And the flip side of it, the states of loving kindness, of compassion, of generosity, have a feeling that does align with well-being. And so the mind begins to gravitate towards that. So mindfulness has got this great double-edged capacity to it. And so not only can we investigate and benefit from investigating our reactivity, but we can investigate and benefit from investigating happiness, joy, peace, generosity, love, to be familiar, to get familiar with those as well. And there's a lot more to say about that. Maybe I'll talk about that the next time I'm here. I think, yeah, next week. I'm here next week. So maybe I'll talk more about investigating the wholesome side of things next week and open it for some questions right now. Any comments or questions?
And my investigation from during the week has, if it was investigation, I know there was a lot of analysis in there.
Well, it's really helpful to know the difference, right? I mean, mind will analyze.
Yes.
The mind will analyze.
Yeah, and what I thought was particularly helpful in your talk, to me, in this talk this morning, was a reminder that investigation, in the way we're using the word, is awareness of what I'm feeling. So I've peeled back the layers to fear, and it seems a lot like the fear you mentioned in your experience. It's a fear of not getting my needs met, and they'll never get met,
mm-hmm.
whatever those particular needs or interests are. So that's about as far as I've gone, but it was.
I
learned one other thing. There's another fear. I almost forgot it. The other fear is, if I won't get my needs met, at least I need to get back in control.
There you go.
I mean, that my needs for you know, comfort and. They're sort of the soft needs, and so now I get angry because anger, I learned, way more than 20 years ago, helps me get back in control.
Yeah. I mean, so the two pieces there, I mean, kind of relating to, you know, we talked about last week, the kind of connection to wanting to be in control, wanting to be safe, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, your investigation is beginning to reveal some of those threads. What I'd encourage mostly is the meeting of whatever is obvious again. So the fear itself, you know, we can, you know, seeing that, for instance, seeing that, oh, anger comes about because I want to be in control. We can kind of leap to knowing that, and then it's like we start thinking about that rather than actually meeting. Oh, what does it feel like to have that feeling of anger? And then allow the threads of, oh, feels out of control, you know, to kind of bubble up and then be known so that it's really that willingness to just meet experience and allow the threads to reveal themselves. So it can take time, you know. My story reveals that, so, you know.
Yeah, and I've at least thought about this kind of, you know, my tendency to go from 0 to 60 in 2.1 seconds or less with anger. You know, I've thought about, I've been chastised about it enough over my lifetime that it always feels urgent to get on with the investigation, so I won't do it again.
There is some urgency. I mean, there is some urgency,
yes,
but there is the only place to meet that is in the moment when it arises, and the you know, the ideas, when we start to, you know, when we think, oh, it's urgent, we tend to go into the thinking about, analyzing, figuring out. And, you know, so much of our figuring out mind has our habits of conditioning in it. And so that figuring out mind itself has a habit of anger in it. You know, it's like, I need to get rid of this. So the you know, the mindfulness, the kind of the attitude of mindfulness of, oh, can I just meet this? Can I just open to this? Can I be okay that this is happening right now? You know, fortunately, when we are observing and investigating in that way, it does provide some degree of protection for us, that we can be more, we can have more capacity to not act out when we are exploring, meeting our experience in that way. And it is a slow process. I mean, it is a process that unfolds over a long time.
Well, what I'm trying to investigate, to become fully aware of, has taken a long time to build up.
Yeah.
Like,
have you seen any shift in yourself?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so...
especially on the freeway.
Let yourself acknowledge that shift, because that can really help to support the confidence that this is beneficial. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, in the back. Yeah.
Your comment about looking at the digital clock and then making that connection back to Disney World, and then suddenly it had lost its sort of power. It just reminds me of one thing I heard Gil say in a talk at one point, where he compared that experience to discovering what was behind the magician's trick.
Yes, yes,
and
it's beautiful. Yes.
Once you see, oh, this is how it works, suddenly
it can't fool you anymore.
And it can't fool you anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that was exactly the experience.
Yeah.
It couldn't fool me anymore. Thank you for that. Yeah, Arthur.
I want to describe an experience, and I'm confused about the last piece of it. That's the question.
Okay.
It's habitual. I see it frequently. When I'm driving, it's one of the places. I find myself all caught up and feeling very tense. And recently, I've been sometimes remembering to say, "This is suffering. This feels like suffering. It's horrible." And I'm doing things that are making it worse, the way I'm driving and so forth. And when that happens, it sort of goes away, just evaporates. And, it doesn't just evaporate. Actually, what happens is there's another thought that I have plenty of time, and if I'm late, I'm not good, you know, it's just late to where I'm going, that's all. And then it goes away. And as that falls away, I can't explain this exactly, but at some point I get to some different level, another layer of this. And when I get down to that layer, I don't particularly feel angry or, you know, I'm feeling fairly relaxed and okay. But I feel some discomfort. It's very subtle. And then I realize I walk around with this all the time. And then I realize that, what's the cause of it? And the cause of suffering, the cause is wanting. And then I'm thinking, and so this is all, it's not an analytical process. These are things that are just unfolding. And not at one time.
Mm-hmm.
the final piece of it is sort of recognizing that I am always wanting things. As I'm driving, this is going on. And they're not even important things. But there's just stuff wanting, always.
Uh-huh.
And it's keeping me agitated constantly.
So you're describing kind of, you know, this is kind of the way the investigation works, you know. It's like as we see certain, like, layers of our patterning fall away. I mean, like, the largest layer, the most obvious kind of suffering was the anger driving. And then recognizing, oh, yeah, okay, I've got enough time. It's like that layer can fall away. And this is one thing to recognize, too, in the investigation, you know, sometimes bringing in just wisdom reflections, just reminders. Yeah, you know, of course, you know, this is dukkha. This is kind of it's a wisdom reflection. Bringing in, no, there's enough time. So that those kinds of reflections basically replace the thoughts of mind of, I got to be in a hurry, I got to get where I'm going. And so those patterns of mind fall away, which is kind of what was perpetuating the larger kind of suffering. And so because that kind of perpetuation part has fallen away, the pattern has a chance to just kind of dissipate. And then because that kind of grosser level of reactivity is not present, you know, over time, we start to become aware that there are subtler layers of discomfort, unease that are present. And we do start to become aware of kind of a more pervasive layer of that. It's just the same kind of exploration that we do at the larger layers. It's the same kind of exploration. The thing I would caution is, you know, we have the idea, we have the recognition or understanding perhaps, yes, dukkha comes from wanting something, you know, and so we kind of start looking for what it is we're wanting. And that's kind of more in the realm of our ideas guiding the investigation, and it can be helpful. You know, we might begin to recognize, oh yeah, look at this, I want that, I want that, I want that. And yet the power of the seeing, it's like that seeing from the level of having an idea, what is it that I want, and then seeing, oh yeah, I want that. It can be helpful, and we do recognize, oh yeah, I do want that, and we see how we're kind of attached to it. And that may help us to then be more aware when that kind of wanting comes up in the future. But the power is to actually see the wanting, not from an idea, but the recognition of, ah, there it is. And the way to that is to really just, oh, there's discomfort here. What does that feel like? And, you know, again, kind of in that kaleidoscope way, that discomfort will reveal the patterns underneath it by just, oh, discomfort, that's what's here. Can I just meet that? Rather than trying to dig and figure out what it is that I want or where it is that I'm caught. I mean, knowing the way it works can be helpful, but it also can get in the way of allowing a more organic revealing of what's happening. So I would just encourage you to, I mean, it can be challenging when we kind of land in a deeper level of kind of pervasive dissatisfaction, you know, that can be challenging to just allow that and to live with it. And yet it's, you know, it sounds like it's not that, it's more the pervasiveness of it than the discomfort of it, right?
It's more the root.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't have that. There's no urgency to it. It's just.
So knowing that it's pervasive, it gives you much more opportunity to explore it. But be really patient. Yeah, really patient. And there's probably, in my experience with the more pervasive ones like that, it's really that it's a similar pattern around a lot of different things. You know, it's like the same feeling of wanting to find something that'll make me happy. And the mind's kind of staying agitated looking for it. So it's not so much about the thing that we want as it is the pattern of wanting to find something.
So, you know, as you say that, I there's what's winding the clock there is me wanting the answer.
Yes. So just explore. And we need to stop now. Thank you for your attention.